Welcome to the School Sucks Project, a podcast, YouTube channel, and online community dedicated to personal growth and intellectual self-defense.
We promote learning alternatives, home education, critical thinking, peaceful parenting, organization and productivity, and better communication strategies.
Please remember to visit schoolsucksproject.com to get comprehensive show notes, relevant links,
or to just leave comments.
Follow us on Twitter at SchoolSucksShow. Subscribe to our YouTube channel, username SchoolSucksPodcast, and get involved in our Facebook group. Just search for School Sucks Project.
I kind of thought, well, it'd be fun to go to my senior year of high school just because there's a lot of people around. You know, I did grow up in this kind of mindset and this thing the school teaches us to really want to be around people a lot, to derive our value from other people, largely, to derive our self-esteem from how other people perceive us, like right. Gatto talks about in his essay.
Provisional self-esteem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so, you know, I always felt better being around people, and I'm actually trying to build up more and more my self-esteem so I don't need that, because I think that's something that a lot of people my age really feel, is that need to be around other people to be confident, to be comfortable and everything. And I still notice that a lot in myself.
What do you think that is?
Honestly, I mean, I honestly think that it is school. Just like Gatto writes in his essay, it's, I forget which of the functions it is of schooling, but it's to make people feel like you need other people's approval to feel good. And so I'm trying to use things like mindfulness, meditation, logic, you know, a lot of writing, a lot of reading, keeping myself busy and becoming more and more comfortable with myself to unschool myself from that aspect of what I learned. But it's difficult. It can be very challenging. So
it's one of Nathaniel Brandon's pillars of self-esteem. You're familiar with that, right?
I listened to some of the episodes that you have done on right. that, but I have not dug in quite enough.
Well, the third one is personal responsibility. And yeah. this idea speaks to what you're saying perfectly. You're talking about operating on what can I do for myself? How can I be the best friend to myself mm-hmm. instead of needing other friends or romantic relationships yeah, or approval yeah, yeah. from adults? No one is coming. You know, I think that's the line that Brandon uses yeah. in the book. No one is coming to save you. No one is coming yeah. to help. Like, accept that, right?
Yeah.
And then you are in the perfect position to be yeah. self-responsible.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's huge.
One human.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the show. Today is Friday, April 6th, and I'm just going to zip through a quick intro here because I'm headed to Pittsburgh today to see my pals and go to a party. I'm excited. I'm going to get to meet a lot of new people. And another thing, a few days ago, last weekend, actually, we recorded a bonus show on the topic of health and fitness where I teamed up with a competition power lifter to give Andrew, from a lot of the bonus content recently, some advice on beginning a gym routine. And we also talked a lot about diet because that's a huge part of it. I'll be putting that out sometime next week. But we wound up getting into a lot of detail about exercise. So I was like, if I have a reason to go to Pittsburgh anyway, why should I just sit on Skype and explain this stuff with my voice when I could go there and demonstrate it with my body? Most importantly, this is the continuation of my conversation with Matt Maruca. Grab a notebook, huh? Folks, a lot of stuff is covered in this show. We're going to talk about what happened with Matt after he returned from Bosnia, his continued quantum health research, and how he used what he was learning to create a successful business. It's all coming up on the show today. So let's get right to it. Thanks for listening, everybody, and take care. When we finished the first part of our conversation, which was 3.5 hours ago, right? So then we got in my car. We went to Philly. Was that a good time?
Yes, it was pretty fun. It was cool.
I love that crew. I really look forward to every chance I get to hanging out with those guys. So I'm glad you get to meet them. And that wasn't even the whole group. There was a couple guys named Phil who weren't there. Yeah. So we'll have to do that again sometime. But where we left off, you were talking about your trip for 10 months when you were in high school to what used to be Yugoslavia.
Yeah.
You educated me and everyone on the audience on the history of that. That was so much new information for me and so many people who are listening, mm-hmm. trust me. But you wanted to go into that detail, and I definitely wanted to make a place for you to do that. because you see it as a turning point in your life where you started Absolutely. To have these interactions with people outside of the United States on issues related to the United States, politics, government, mm-hmm. foreign policy.
Oh, yeah.
That opened your eyes to, I think the way you described it is there was more ways to see this, or there was much more to know than what yeah. had been provided to you at that point.
Absolutely.
It made me think of a metaphor I'd used on the show a couple of times when talking about history or even some kind of like political issue. And it's the metaphor of the movie scene, right? So you can come up with an idea for a scene that you want to film in the movie. You know the actors you need to use, the lines they have to say, you know the setting where it's going to be. But then you have almost an infinite variety of choices for the story that you can still tell based on the lighting you use, you know, the camera angles, the lenses, how much you zoom in. I don't mean to torture this metaphor, but like yeah. what you're zooming in on. You can even, with all of these choices, tell two diametrically opposed stories using the same characters in the same script in some yeah. cases, if you're creative enough with the other choices that you make. So the same applies to the way historical stories are told. The same applies to current events and political issues. And I'm watching a lot of people your age right now in the United States. Today is what? April 1st, Easter. You know, the hottest topic right now is this gun debate, the school shooting thing, Parkland. You know, those are people your age. And the thing that's really strikes me as particularly unfortunate about it, as I've, you know, watched the way the issue's been framed to kind of motivate them. And I said to you when we were driving back from Philly, I said, yeah, it was kind of hyperbolic, but I was like, it's like the Matrix, right? They're like harnessing the energy of the rebellious energy of young people for the power of the state, right? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, to basically limit people's freedoms even more. And that's kind of tragic. But in my last podcast with Thaddeus Russell, I was saying, what? I don't get this NRA thing, right? Like everything's about the NRA, you know? And they're not even like one of the biggest 400 lobbies in the country, you know, as far as the money they give the politicians. And, you know, he kind of hinted at it. And then when this one of the kids like did this advertising boycott on a conservative talk radio host this past week, to kind of like it, which exposes to me something that happens a lot on that political side, the very non-libertarian side of politics, we're really after your money, mm-hmm. right? This is really about taking from the haves and rewarding the have-nots, or punishing the haves is kind of like the theme. And then I said, oh, all right, I understand why this film scene has been set up this way, that the zoom is all the way in on the NRA. The lens is one so that every other part of this issue besides the NRA and the money they give to politicians is out of focus.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
And why the light is so bright, exposing all of the flaws of this organization and the people who are a part of it. It's because this is the story that kids love, right?
Yeah.
It's the haves and the have nots. It's one of the reasons why like left wing economics and politics are so appealing to people your age, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because there are other 18-year-olds who've never earned a dollar in their life, who have a net worth of zero. If they're going to college, it's much less than that, right? If they had to take loans.
Yeah.
And this is a winning story. This is a story that makes people like Bernie Sanders incredibly attractive. And it's also simple. But if you don't know how different treatments of events, whether they're historical or current, can be constructed and framed and even manipulated, you think you're getting the whole story.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so many people your age are so susceptible to that right now. But you're having this experience in another country that was a real education for you.
Absolutely.
Right? Where you say, okay, for whatever reason, whatever, I mean, there could have been a multitude of factors that contributed to this. But you come back from there, I'm sure it was happening while you were there too, and you say, this thing that I had seen, this reframed your thinking mm-hmm. in many ways about not just the country, but the world. So yeah. I want to hear about like, now I'm commending you for this, but it's actually, I use that metaphor because I'm going to put a challenging question to you soon.
Please do.
Using that metaphor again. But I want to hear first about what happened next.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's lots of aspects to the whole story. Usually when I tell the Bosnia story, it's because what I did when I got there was what I had mentioned earlier throughout my health journey was that after the diets and things failed me and I had gone through all these binge disorders and whatnot, I learned about specifically one health blogger and a neurosurgeon located in the Gulf South named Dr. Jack Kruse, who I mentioned to you in the car ride. And he's fairly well known throughout a lot of health circles in the country now. Most people who are, you know, following things like Bulletproof and Dave Asprey and those things like that are becoming, you know, more well known know about this guy. But essentially what he's doing and what he was pointing out is that when our mitochondria, which are these engines in our cells that allow us to make energy, basically, when they don't work properly, we could be eating the best diet in the world, but we're not going to be able to maintain it. Because, for example, one thing that relates to me is that in order for us to be able to burn fat effectively, for example, like ketosis you mentioned you were in earlier, we need to have pretty highly functioning mitochondria to be able to maintain that state. And so
it's something for an already kind of optimized being.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. Like, sure. For example, you know, people, Native Americans, for example, someone told me a story that they read from one of the journals of Lewis and Clark. And basically there was some, you know, they were on the road and they hadn't eaten anything for 12 days except some berries. You know, they hadn't eaten for 12 days. And then one of these Native Americans, who are obviously the most connected humans in, you know, in the recent history, they were living super, they were like wild humans, essentially, you know, not domesticated, not in civilization. He was riding the horse in a way that the Lewis and Clark and the European or the white man didn't really appreciate. So they kicked him off his horse and they made him run to a kill that they had finally gotten. And he sprinted, as far as it's documented, basically full speed, almost all the way about something like 2 miles along the horses and got to the kill with them. And the friend who mentioned this was just, you know, using it as an example of how people back then could do such physically amazing things. I mean, this is specifically Native Americans who are living in the wild, essentially surviving. But the point is there. Basically, these people were living in an environment that's connected to nature, which is what I soon learned is actually optimal for our mitochondria, because they're these electromagnetic organisms and they're controlled by largely light frequencies and lighting and these kinds of things. So anyway, I had learned about that before I was going to Bosnia. And basically the analogy I got was, you know, think about a car. It has an engine and a gas tank. And so in our body, we're like the car. We have our engines in our cells, and then we have the gas we put in. Mm-hmm. And I gave this analogy at lunch to one of the guys who was interested. If we're eating the best food on the planet, but our engines aren't working well, like, for example, same thing with a car. If it's getting premium gas, but someone has poured, you know, a bunch of syrup into the engine, so it's going to be all sticky and clogged up, that premium gas isn't going to do anything. But so what I started to learn from this neurosurgeon and a lot of the researchers, really, he just ties a lot of, you know, PhDs and stuff together in a way that I could understand. And even then, it's pretty difficult to understand without some background, some book reading. But basically, I learned that, you know, the way we're living, largely the indoor disconnected lifestyle, huge amounts of artificial lighting, complete absence of sunlight for most people. You know, almost no one's making vitamin D. The whole society's vitamin D deficient, essentially. We have loads of other health issues related to lack of sunlight, like high blood pressure has been linked to that. A lot of other things have just been linked to that. And then there's a whole nother issue, which is something we could talk about separately, which is the electromagnetic kind of bath that we're creating for ourselves with artificial, you know, just, for example, our power grid is putting us in a frequency range that is different from what our mitochondria are optimized for, which
indoor
is
light,
natural
right.
frequency. Well, not just indoor light, but also the invisible parts of the spectrum that are still electromagnetic, such as power lines, power cords, wiring in a house. Like right now we're sitting in a 60 hertz field around us. We can't see it, feel it, or touch it, but it affects the electromagnetic mitochondria. And the same thing goes for this, you know, for example, what most people refer to as the tinfoil hat conspiracy, which is something I was really interested in talking about, because
right.
I've heard you mention one time on one episode and it pissed me off, because I was like, these people are supposed to be logical. They talk about logic, but you mentioned the tinfoil hat conspiracy as like a just, or something about tinfoil hat as like a some kind of justification for something, as it typically is in the mainstream culture. But as someone who used to believe the mainstream thing, and then I've gone now and reviewed the evidence with, like, you know, trying to be logical, open-minded, of the hundreds of researchers who claim that, you know, cell phones and radio frequency radiation is, and microwave radiation is not biologically safe, as like the government and the intergovernmental panels and the Navy and all these large organizations have said. I learned about that too, and that was pretty interesting. And that's one of the core philosophies that kind of relate to this environmental thing. Other things like, you know, water being a pretty important factor, and that the another thing that sounds like a conspiracy, for example, like fluoride having a negative effect on human brain function. There's a good amount of evidence on that. But these things we're all learning, I was learning about, and yeah, I thought these were all conspiracies all the while, but it seemed to make sense. So I decided to apply these things because I was desperate. As I had mentioned, I was absolutely desperate. And even after going to this one functional health doctor.
Can we just make a connection just for a second?
Absolutely.
The trip that you went on, though, was an opening to things you had learned about before, and now you started to want, like you said, okay, my mind is open to the possibility of another way.
Yeah.
I might be right, I might be wrong.
Yeah, absolutely.
I need to do more experimentation, but you had this really impactful experience for 10 months, and that led you to springing into action in other investigations.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so actually it was on this trip, the reason I preface with those things is it was on this trip that I applied those protocols that I had learned about. Basically, you know, the simplest way to put them is like how lighting affects our biology, how invisible lighting, like different kinds of electromagnetic radiation affect our biology, the water we drink, and diet too plays a role. For example, there's other factors too, like how being exposed to natural temperature changes rather than being in a constantly heated air bath of, you know, 60 to 70 degrees or whatever it is, the standard indoor temperature, which is totally unnatural. We're designed to be exposed to the cold. And there's tons of evidence now, especially due to a guy named Wim Hof, this ice man from the Netherlands. Yeah, he's super famous because he's challenging everything people thought they knew. So another thing I learned from this neurosurgeon, which is what got me interested, was this protocol he wrote out called the cold thermogenesis protocol, which is basically training our body to activate the fat burning pathway that we all have. Every mammal has it. I mean, if you believe in evolution, since the asteroid that caused the dinosaurs to go extinct, 93% of the mammal, the Eutherian mammal ancestor that was alive at that time died, according to their estimates. But the percent that survived were able to innovate an adaptation we had that allowed us to burn fat while hibernating and to use that while waking in response to a significantly cooled Earth after all the gases from the asteroid blocked out the sun for however long it was. Mm-hmm. And so all mammals today, even the ones that live in the tropics or in Africa, still have this pathway. It's just most don't utilize it. But the ones that live in the cold, like seals, whales, dolphins, wolves, squirrels, you know, any mammal that lives anywhere where it gets cold for even a part of the year uses this pathway. It's a mitochondrial pathway. It's called the leptin melanocortin pathway in Eutherian mammals, where it, and that's just science talk, but basically we use these uncoupling proteins. So in response to surface cold, it triggers basically a response to through the nervous system to the brain, which then basically talks back to the brown fat mass, which is if brown fat is basically fat that has lots of mitochondria, because mitochondria are brown, and it activates these things called uncoupling proteins, which basically poke a hole in the mitochondrial electron transport chain, causing protons that are supposed to be divided by a gradient to flow back down the gradient when they're usually not supposed to. But this basically tricks the mitochondria into thinking that we're dying and that it massively needs to upregulate energy production. But the cool thing is, and this is some of the stuff I've learned about that's just, it's my passion, it's what I'm fascinated about, and I'll share more about where people could read about this at the end of the show. But basically, when we moved away from the equator, humans all had one common mitochondrial haplotype, which is basically a type of mitochondria. And when we moved away from the equator, again, if you believe in evolution, but this is what the science shows, our haplotypes, the types of mitochondria, basically changed. So, for example, in Africa, a human isn't going to freeze to death, but it's going to need to run away from, for example, lions or tigers. So the mitochondria need to be extremely efficient to survive in an environment like that. And so the mitochondria of an African person do not release a lot of heat, or anyone of that descent. They don't release much heat. They're highly efficient. If they eat one banana, for example, they're going to make almost all of that energy into ATP as much as possible. Highly efficient process. Whereas someone who's a Northern European descent has a different haplotype, because we don't have to run away from lions and tigers, but we're going to freeze to death.
So it's almost like a slowing down?
Yeah. Well, okay. It's not necessarily slowing down, but so when that adaptation of the...
A decreased efficiency.
Decreased efficiency, yeah. But that means more heat production. So it's basically instead of making it all into ATP, we release a lot as heat, which on one hand, it might seem counterintuitive, like, oh, we would want to be more efficient. But actually, if you're going to freeze to death and you can use that to make more heat, then that's a huge deal. So anyone, any mammal, even like, you know, someone who's African-American or whatever African descent can utilize this, but it might take more time and they might not be as effective because, for example, you and I are of Northern European descent, generally, it looks like. So because we both have white skin, so we both have a higher adaptation to use this pathway. So I was interested in that. That's what really caught my eye of this neurosurgeon. It wasn't all the stuff about light and electromagnetic radiation and all this other stuff. It was this being able to get in an ice bath that's below, you know, 40 degrees and burn my own fat and stay warm. And I started doing that. So now, yeah, I can withstand cold like nobody's business. I mean, I take ice baths all the time. I swim in freezing water. And it actually improves mitochondrial function by forcing the mitochondria to kind of work. So the reason I bring that up.
Will cold showers do?
Yes, cold showers are a great start.
What's the process for that? Are you doing a hot shower after that, or
starting with cold because, ending with cold because that way, if you end air drying as well, because it basically forces the body to heat itself back up, rather than using
hot water,
shower. Yeah,
okay.
Using the hot water or the towel to dry the water. If you leave the water in your body when it evaporates, it's going to take a lot of heat with it. That's just the way that works. That's why you're colder if you leave your hair wet than dry.
Yeah,
so. So cold showers work. I mean, I personally, because I'm kind of a wimp sometimes, it'd be ideal. The best is if you just go in the shower and you just go immediately cold, and get a total rush. It like activates this mammalian dive reflex, from way back when we had to, you know, dive for fish. I think it was during that extinction event that was innovated. But the body will naturally take a huge like gasp for air, and you'll feel like a crazy head rush.
I've done it. So yep.
Because I mean, the tap water here is freezing right now. In the summer, when I take like ice baths, I have a feeding trough for like animals that I use to like bathe in. It's big. It's like 100 gallons, and I'll have to use a lot of ice. And I have a chest freezer I make ice with. But in the winter, it's great. Like right now, it's great because the sun's getting stronger, but also the water's still cold. So. Yeah, cold showers are fine. There's a guy named Ben Greenfield.
Well, like how long? How many days a week? Like what are some of the numbers that you would – like if somebody is trying
to just start
– get feet wet.
Get your feet wet. I'd say just start your shower hot and then just slowly turn it to cold as much as you can possibly tolerate in the beginning. And then, you know, I'd basically just go until – as long as you can in your shower. Like say a minute to start, or even 30 seconds to start, and then a minute, and then 5 minutes. And I mean, usually I'll start with a hot shower instead of just really cold because I like the way a hot shower feels, but then I'll go pretty cold by the end and try to go 100% cold and freeze.
For how long?
I'll go for 5 to 10 minutes just cold. And so I take long showers when I do because I do half hot and half cold. But but I'm not taking all the hot water. It's like, you know.
Right.
So at least it's not that because I live in a house with other people at the moment. But that's like a start. You know, I'd recommend if anyone's interested, you can look up cold thermogenesis. And this guy, Dr. Jack Cruz, who I mentioned, will come up his protocols. It's pretty simple the way I adapted. It's starting with head dunks in a bucket of ice water for a few weeks, like 2 to 3 weeks, I think. And then moving on to using like an ice pack on your chest. I mean, you could do that while laying down, listening to an audiobook or something, because that stimulates the skin a lot. And then moving to the ice bath after you've been able to do it with a compression shirt for a few, like 2 weeks, and then no compression shirt for 2 weeks, just bare skin with the ice bag, and then going to the tub and starting to go cold. But I started going way too cold. I started in the 40s when I started, which was like terrible. I probably almost made myself hypothermic. Like I was shivering for 3 hours after the first time I did it. So, but yeah, I mean, eventually, like, for example, going out with less clothing on in the cold, like, and then the key thing that I have to mention is that from what I learned, the more we do these other things to improve mitochondrial function, like, for example, improving our sleep is huge because that's the evidence is showing that that's the largest time when we repair our whole body, but that includes the mitochondria. So, and that's why I'll get to it, but I started a company and we sell blue light blocking glasses that basically, and there are other companies doing this and other products, but none were attractive because it was like a kind of a very niche health community. And a lot of people were wearing these just like really unattractive, orange safety goggles from Amazon. And one company came out and started putting these blue light blocking lenses into stylish frames, and they still weren't that good quality. So that's why I started my company. The reason blue light blocking is of interest for people who haven't heard of it and might, you know, trigger like some, oh, that's a conspiracy or that's crap. It's basically, you could just look it up. I mean, if Harvard is to be believed, which in a lot of the time they're not necessarily, you know, just because it's a university doesn't mean what they say is true. But Harvard and a lot of other universities and researchers have done studies on how lighting affects our sleep. You know, everyone has probably seen that Apple introduced night shift on the iPhones, and there's loads of articles now about how being up late can affect our sleep if we're on our devices.
And there's plenty of, I mean, there's so many apps for this, and
yeah. Oh, yeah.
Also it's like almost the number one or number two pieces of advice on anything you see about sleeping better.
Yeah,
is
yeah.
Unplug. You know, get devices and laptop screens,
yeah.
And computer screens away from your face hours before you go to bed.
Oh yeah, it's huge. The interesting thing is, you know, as someone who's running my business now mostly on the computer, I want to be able to be on my computer after dark, at least a bit. You know, my cutoff is like 9 p.m. I don't go any later, except maybe occasionally, but I'll cut off. But I have these blue light blocking glasses where as soon as the sun goes down and it's dark, in order to maintain that proper biological rhythm, I put on my blue light blocking glasses. And the reason blue light is, in short, when life was evolving, you know, who knows exactly how it happened. But anyway, there's loads of studies now that have shown that there's a receptor in our eye besides our rods and cones, and it's called melanopsin, and it's specifically sensitive, unlike the rods and cones, which are sensitive to all visible light frequencies from like 300 nanometers or a little higher all the way up to 700. It's only sensitive to a very specific range from about 450 to 500 nanometers, which is blue. It's more like even 465 to 485 is like the peak sensitivity. But the melanopsin receptor is linked to these pathways behind our eye that go to the brain, and specifically to the hypothalamus and a piece of our hypothalamus called the suprachiasmatic nucleus. No one needs to know that, but that's the central timekeeper of the body, where our circadian rhythm, which controls a lot of our hormones, our sleep-wake cycle, and everything is located. And so the point is that what those, you know, it's been shown, like Harvard, a lot of other studies, blue specifically, are picked up, blue frequencies are picked up by that receptor, and then that signals to the brain, okay, is it day or is it night? Should we start making melatonin or should we start releasing melatonin because it's made during the daytime from the interaction of ultraviolet light with certain amino acids in our eye and in our brain, but catalyzed largely by ultraviolet light frequencies, which is one of the reasons why I also have come to believe that ultraviolet light isn't the cause of cataracts, glaucoma, and skin cancer and all these things. It's another separate issue. A lot of these things are very different from the mainstream. But anyway, the whole issue of the blue light is something that you could read about yourself. And my company's called Ra Optics, R-A Optics. It's like Ra, the sun god, because it's all about getting back towards more natural lighting. But, you know, people can check that out later. We'll talk about that more later. But basically, you know, I learned that stuff. I went to Bosnia, and I didn't even realize it, but like I said earlier in the show, that when I was leaving my school called Harrison High School, I was leaving the part that was holding me back intellectually, but also what I didn't know is that the environment, the physical environment, electromagnetically, I'm sitting in artificial lighting from before the sun even comes up during the winter. We go in there, the sun hasn't even risen yet, it's dark outside, we're sitting in these disgustingly fluorescently lit classrooms, horrible for brain function, and then also like we're bathing in Wi-Fi and every single kid has a computer. And again, this is something that most people will be like, oh, that Wi-Fi has no health effect, but I challenge everyone who claims to be intellectual and logical and open-minded to go and read the research. Try, instead of Google searching, does Wi-Fi have a health effect or could it have harm? Because that'll just bring up the mainstream, you know, perspectives. Oh, no, obviously that's disproven. Go and check out, you know, something, research something like, you know, just type in the keywords like Wi-Fi causes health effects, and then you'll see what comes up. That's how you get the other perspective if you type in, if you're looking.
That's actually a good place to pause. You bring up something interesting, and I said this was a challenge that I wanted to put to you. When young people assert
out of the mainstream positions, right? Like what kids think they're doing now, right? Yeah. They're taking on the establishment,
yeah.
right? While supporting the establishment in every way. But they think they're doing that,
yeah.
right? So the thing that I would hate to do or hate to be seen as doing is to have you on the show as an 18-year-old making my case for me. Right. Mm-hmm. And just saying, here's a young person who agrees with
yeah,
me.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah, 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 of course.
So I do, when we get to the school sucks part, I'm going to ask you the same question.
Okay.
But I want to ask you the question about Cruise and all this research that you did on mitochondria and blue mm-hmm. light. I could imagine, and I'm just saying, like, this is just, you know, a question that you have to ask, or I have to ask, because the thing that would be the accusation that would be put against you is you're 18, you lack wisdom. Right? Mm-hmm. You clearly are very smart. You're a clear thinker. There's no doubt about that. But I would want to know, and I bet other people would want to know too, as you discovered these things and you saw them as answers, how did you subject them to scrutiny or skepticism? Because I'm kind of superimposing my younger self
yeah.
onto you right now.
Yeah.
As soon as I found some like out of the mainstream shit, like I know something you don't know stuff, mm-hmm. I was off and running with it. You know?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, did that ever happen to you? Did you ever have to backtrack? Or how do you feel to your own satisfaction as you've discovered these things, you've properly scrutinized them?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's tough for me to draw a line because, for example, two things that I just can't help but mention. One friend of mine who's like, I wouldn't say a conspiracy theorist, but he's very funny and he's very into examining these things such that he's – I mean – like certain things that I would call maybe conspiracy theories, or most people would call them that, such that he accepts a lot of things that, you know, I, even as open-minded and as, you know, into a lot of stuff that other, like I'd say, you know, as far as like 1 to 10 conspiracy theorist scale, I'd say, you know, I'm a 0, but, you know, most people would see me as like a 7 or something or an 8, you know,
right,
say I'm a 0 because I've tested these things and I'll explain how. But he's like a 10 or a 15, you know. So, for example, recently, I don't know if you've heard about this guy named QAnon posting on the internet talking about how there's like a massive sex trafficking scandal among leading politicians and stuff.
Uh-huh.
And I mean, he might be right. You know, Q, this guy apparently claims to be inside of Trump's insider ring and he's made all these predictions and they've been somehow proven to be true. You know, based on certain timestamps of when he said something and then when Trump said something afterwards. I don't know. I haven't really looked into it too much. I don't really want to spend my time on that right now. But
sure.
But still, you know, that's something where I was like, okay, it's a bit out there, so I'm not even going to dig into it at the moment. And then another thing that the same friend referenced to me is a book called Who Made the Moon? And it basically theorizes that the moon is also like somehow either created by like something not like human or some, I don't know. I couldn't
reptilians,
really tell you. Yeah,
it's
I couldn't
a spaceship.
I couldn't tell you anything about it. So like these are things where even I who some people would consider to be like a conspiracy theorist, I'll say, okay, no. But as far as the things that I was doing, keep in mind, I was desperate. So perfect person to fall for something that wouldn't be logical and wouldn't make sense and then deceive myself via the placebo effect that it was working. So keep that in mind. Anyone who's listening to this, highly skeptical with anything I've said about blue light or water with fluoride or sunlight actually being good for life forms that derive their existence from it, possibly,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
and things like, you know, yeah, electromagnetic fields like Wi-Fi and power lines having an effect on biology, you know, it'd be like, that's crazy. But so what I did, the way I tested these things was I applied them and, you know, I just went full force and I went from being, you know, and I applied them while I was in this new environment because one of the key things that this neurosurgeon and other people in this community who are, you know, proponents of it, they'll espouse the benefit of moving your environment because a lot of people with diseases, what this evidence implies that I had come across is that if you are sick with a mitochondrial disease, which there's a guy in, I was mentioning to you earlier in Philadelphia, CHOP, who has, his name's Dr. Doug Wallace, for anyone interested. He's basically shown and continues to show, and he's on the path for a Nobel Prize, that heart disease, Alzheimer's, cancer, diabetes, even autism is his big focus right now, are mitochondrial diseases. And so, you know, and that basically what that means is that the mitochondria are damaged and not the nucleus, the nuclear genes, the DNA, which is where 98% of research is spent looking with no results. He's shown it's in the mitochondria. And so he isn't quite on these environmental things. That's kind of like a a bit more, I'd say, cutting edge, and that's something that bloggers and people are putting together from other researchers, because he's very focused, like most researchers, very specific, so doesn't necessarily have the ability to jump out. Otherwise, he might lose his funding and grant money that they need to write certain types of articles to maintain. But so I was applying these things over there in Bosnia, and I was thinking, you know, basically, okay, if this stuff is ever going to work, it's going to work now, because I did that thing. I moved my environment to a new environment where I, you know, I did everything I could basically as far as these ideas. So if they were true, they'd probably work for me, because I went to a place with less non-native electromagnetic radiation is the term for it, like less, you know, cell towers, less Wi-Fi. It's kind of back in time over there. I had more high quality food, natural food. I had more sunlight. I was walking around the town. I was drinking higher quality water with less things that the government puts in, like fluoride and chloride and everything. And so, you know, all things would have said that I would have gotten better as long as I followed these protocols. And I did. And literally, I changed so much physically. Like, I was the skinniest of all my friends. And they made fun of me in eighth grade and throughout middle school, largely probably because I was a vegetarian. That's contributed, I'm sure. But I
came, and you're talking about in the past.
In the past, before. Yeah, and then I came back from this, you know, 10-month only exchange, and I was more physically healthy and fit and toned, like muscularly, than any of my friends. And they're all like, well, what the hell? You know, how'd you do this? And, you know, not all of them, but the ones who were curious and interested. And, you know, that was one thing. I mean, I went from feeling like crap to not feeling like crap. So basically, you know, a lot of times, you know, for example, like my dad, even he'll try to, you know, justify that these things happened because that antibiotic I took with that old functional medicine doctor probably, you know, got rid of some parasite, and that's what he thought was the cure. So yeah, that's possible. And then, you know, some people will say, well, oh, you hit puberty. That's why you grew up a bit, you know, you grew some muscles and all that stuff, and you got tan, obviously, because you were in the sun. But because I was very pale. Like, I used to burn. There's a lot of people who will listen to this and say, yeah, I can't go in the sun because I just burn. I used to just burn. I used to not tan ever. And as soon as I changed my environment, like, I'm not just saying just moving, but actually changing the way I was living my life on a daily basis. And if you live in, like, Manhattan, you could do this, but you could change everything, but you're still in the same place, and there's certain factors there, largely the population density and the things that everyone has with them and the devices people use.
So many things that are out of your control.
So you can't really control. That's why some people in this health community will basically, you know, say that for some people, especially if you have a mitochondrial disease, like one of those chronic diseases, and, you know, like I mentioned, Alzheimer's, autism, heart disease, diabetes. Well, autism's hard to fix because it stems from the mother's mitochondrial damage going into a newborn. So that's almost, I mean, it's very difficult to reverse if at all possible.
How much pushback is there on that?
On what
the targeting the mitochondria instead of the nuclei cell.
What do you mean pushback?
From mainstream, who? Like, because that's a kind of out of the mainstream pursuit in science right now. So is that even acknowledged?
It is. And it, because of this
is there an active debate about it?
Yes. And okay. It's interesting because of this guy at CHOP, Dr. Wallace, there is a lot of progress going on in the field. Like, there's lots of studies being done on mitochondria. To answer your question, Brett, there's really not too much pushback. It's the mitochondrial stuff is growing and expanding, but the stuff that is much younger is certain, you know, more advanced, like forward-thinking bloggers and people like that, and doctors who are piecing together a lot of research. But that's what I was into. As far as, you know, your question about how did I test these things? Yeah. You know, these things aren't a ton of randomized controlled trials in science, because no one's going to fund them, because drug companies don't have, you know, any interest in funding those kinds of studies for these kinds of things. But there's so many people I know who have benefited from it. And then for me, it worked. I came home and I was so much better, and I was just super desirous of sharing this stuff. But that was just, you know, explaining part of that trip that I took. I really changed so much physically on a health level. And that was amazing. But as you were referring to the things I learned about the government, you know, until really listening.
And I want to make a point really quick that absolutely. One of the reasons why I thought, like, getting all as much of the story out as possible is I don't want to be saying to anybody who might be listening to this your age, do what Matt did specifically, but definitely do what Matt did generally. He had these problems, or he had these questions, and he went and he got answers, and he found answers that worked for him. right?
Yeah.
This is not prescriptive in the sense like you need, you know, these glasses and you need this thing and you need this many hours
absolutely
of sleep
not
in your shower. I was asking about the length of the shower for my own interest, right?
Yeah.
Not for everybody else. So, I mean, generally speaking, this is phenomenal, but you were about to say the next thing was what after all
of
this research?
So when I was over there, this is super related to school sucks, all the stuff you were talking about with the way my views on the government changed. Like, yeah, the movie was just absolutely changed. You know, I saw that the things that I was taught weren't necessarily the truths about the matter over there in what was the former Yugoslavia. And, you know, I stopped seeing the government as like, oh, this is the greatest thing. So what happened is I came home from this foreign exchange program for my senior year of high school. And this is kind of interesting. I was thinking about staying there another year because I felt great there. I liked being there in the different culture. So that was my first plan. And then what happened was, you know, I decided I'm going to come home because there's this friend of mine in Silicon Valley who's, you know, he's a programmer. He wants to change the world. He basically convinced me that the best chance I had of having a big impact would be to become a programmer as well and basically work on something like that, like a startup that would have some huge impact. He's all about trying to have the massive impact for the massive number of – the biggest number of people. That wasn't exactly my focus. But so I was thinking about going back, you know, out there to California – or not back, but to Berkeley where he was and maybe trying to start a startup of some kind and skipping my senior year of high school. But then it didn't seem to be super feasible. I didn't really have a plan of what I would do. I would just be kind of living there trying to figure it out. And so I didn't end up doing that. Then I was going to stay back at home for one more year, and I was going to homeschool myself and figure that out and not go to school. But then I kind of thought, well, it'd be fun to go to my senior year of high school just because there's a lot of people around. You know, I did grow up in this kind of mindset and this thing the school teaches us to really want to be around people a lot. And not that that's just school, but to derive our value from other people largely, to derive our self-esteem from how other people perceive us, like Gatto talks about in his essay.
Provisional self-esteem.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, I always felt better being around people, and I'm actually trying to build up more and more my self-esteem so I don't need that, because I think that's something that a lot of people my age really feel, is that need to be around other people to be confident, to be comfortable and everything. And I still notice that a lot in myself.
What do you think that is?
Honestly, I mean, I honestly think that it is school. Just like Gatto writes in his essay, it's – I forget which of the functions it is of schooling, but it's to make people feel like you need other people's approval to feel good. And so I'm trying to use things like mindfulness, meditation, logic, you know, a lot of writing, a lot of reading, keeping myself busy and becoming more and more comfortable with myself to unschool myself from that aspect of what I learned. But it's difficult. Right. It can be very challenging. So
it's one of Nathaniel Brandon's pillars of self-esteem. You're familiar with that, right?
I listened to some of the episodes that you have done on that, but I have not dug in quite enough.
Well, the third one is personal responsibility, right? And this idea that, I mean, it speaks to what you're saying perfectly. You're talking about operating on what can I do for myself? How can I be the best friend to myself instead of needing other friends or, you know, romantic relationships or approval from adults? No one is coming. You know, I think that's the line that Brandon uses in the book. No one is coming to save you. No one is coming to help. Like, accept that, right?
Yeah.
And then you are in the perfect position to be self-responsible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's huge. And so I ended up, though, with this mindset, attending my final year of high school. However, given the stuff I mentioned about health, I didn't want to be in a school all day. I was thinking to myself, okay, I am not going to sit in a school all day long. That's toxic for me. So I'm going to get my morning sunlight. So I'm going to have my counselor basically put it so that all my free periods are in the morning. And then I'm only going to take the minimum graduation requirements. And the reason why I was doing that still wasn't because I was aware of the School Sucks project, podcast, and everything. But it was actually because I had read a book while I was over in Bosnia, which was related to the health stuff. But it's far beyond that. It's by a guy named Andrew Marino, who's a researcher. And he was working under a guy who basically studied how electricity functions in living organisms. And to keep it concise and simple, you know, this guy, Becker, who he was working under, Robert O. Becker, was a leading researcher in electricity and living organisms, and he found all these crazy cool things, like that bone regenerates with a DC electric current. This is pretty well published, and there's a lot of devices that derive from his work today. But then his coworker, his student, this guy Marino, basically was wondering, well, if we have these very intricate electrical systems in our body and our bones, our nerve and cells that we weren't aware of before, is it possible that these high voltage transmission lines that create electromagnetic fields hundreds of thousands of times, if not millions of times stronger than the fields in our body that are super tiny, is it possible that those could have an effect on these very delicate systems? And so he began researching this, and this is just such an interesting story that, you know, basically he got into legal, because he was a PhD and a lawyer, so he got in all these legal battles, and he was always the witness as a scientist, but he had the legal background to be able to withstand cross-examination better than any other witness ever. And so he was the power company's worst enemy. But what they would do, because there was a clause, and this is something, this is so related to School Sucks, just as far as the law and the government, there was a clause in the, I guess it was a precedent by a judge in the Supreme Court called the Frye Standard from all the way back in the early 1900s, where some guy basically murdered someone, and then they tried to use a lie detector to prove his innocence, him and his lawyer. And they had a witness who said that the lie detector was always, you know, telling the truth, even though I guess it was pretty obvious in the context that he was guilty. Mm-hmm. They tried to use this box, you know, that would say, are you guilty? And then
right.
And anyway, the judge didn't know what else to say to disprove this, but to set a standard that scientific evidence cannot be admitted into a court of law unless it is quote unquote generally accepted by the scientific community. And that was the standard. That was the Frye Standard all through the time Marino was working in the courts, or in as a witness. And so they would hire, the power line companies would basically hire, large amounts of Harvard, Yale, Stanford, you know, UCLA PhDs who would basically say, yeah, this guy, Marino, he's not generally accepted by the scientific community.
Like the and, sugar people. Right?
Exactly.
Like, it's like the sugar people.
Yeah. But yeah. It worked. It worked very, very well. And they, you know, they always triumphed because of that. And Marino basically lost out, even though, you know, from the research reading his book, it's called Going Somewhere, Truth About a Life in Science, for anyone interested. It's amazing. And it talks about that science stuff with the NIH that I mentioned earlier. But he basically would always lose. And then he, interestingly enough, his guy Becker, who was the expert who was his teacher, was contracted at one point by the Navy. Keeping in mind, Marino was working on power line radiation, and then Becker was hired by the Navy and with 18 other scientists on a panel to evaluate the health effects of radio frequency radiation, because they were the only people using it at the time for radar. There were no microwaves, there was no Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, cell phones, smartwatches. It was really just radar at the time, mm-hmm. and radio, which was, you know, there was very little density compared to what there is. But the Navy wanted to know if its members were going to get harmed by this radar, because there was some evidence that it was harmful. And all these 19 scientists agreed unanimously that it was harmful and it needed more study for sure. And the Navy classified all those documents and hid them away, because they couldn't just tell, you know, their entire group, you know, during the Cold War too, that all their servicemen are at a risk for cancer and cataracts, which were the two main effects they found from radio frequency radiation, which is non-thermal effects. And people who believe that Wi-Fi, cell phones, all these things are completely safe, it's based on a standard from this international panel of scientists that are almost all – they are all paid experts by the industry, basically to agree that these frequencies can't have an effect unless it's what's called a thermal effect, which means that the density of the radio waves are high enough, or microwaves are high enough, that they actually cook us with heat. So basically the standard right now from that committee called ICNRP, International Committee on Non-Ionizing Radiation Protection. It's non-ionizing because it's not like x-rays where it'll damage us. But basically their standard is that if it doesn't cook us, then it can't have an effect. But that excludes the cataract and cancer effects that they found. So anyway, this guy Marino was involved in all this stuff. And then later on, the Navy even hired a guy named Milton Zaret. They gave him an island in Pearl Harbor and a five-year contract to study the effects of these radio frequencies on all different kinds of animals. And 3 years into it, the captain of the Navy, I think his name was Paul Tyler at the time, he spoke with the Secretary of Defense, and they didn't like what they were finding. Mm-hmm. And so they killed all the animals and discredited the guy publicly and, you know, ended the contract and everything. And that was kind of the end of the debate. You know, that kind of laid the way for things like cell phones, Wi-Fi and stuff to come out with absolutely no challenge from the scientific community, because the U.S. government had such a high vested interest in it being known to be completely safe up to that thermal effect, which is thousands of times higher than where effects were shown by scientists who are doing honest research. But that's something other people can dig into if they want to read that book. But I read that book and I was, you know, again, maybe this guy's wrong. Maybe he's lying, but you have to read that for yourself if you're interested. But I came back and this goes along with a lot of stuff that School Sucks talked about when I started listening to it about a year and a half after this. Like, this was what I saw to be a huge issue in society. Like, people are basically, you know, there's, and again, it sounds like conspiracy to most people, but there's cell towers being constructed all over. Now they're rolling out 5G. I mean, it's just disgusting. I don't even like getting into the details of how the CTIA, which is the telecommunications lobby, essentially, when Motorola was sued for causing someone's brain cancer in the 90s, and then they hired a guy named Dr. George Carlo to run a $28 million study to, again, try to put the nails in the coffin on the issue. Mm-hmm. And then he came out with results that they did not like. He was fired, publicly discredited, and his house was burned down, interestingly enough. And you can, again, people can read this, look him up on YouTube. Like, it's there, but no one talks about it in corporate media, obviously. And so, yeah, they just allowed the proliferation to continue unfettered. And then, interestingly enough, the guy who ran that lobby way back when, the lobby's called CTIA. It's the acronym. It's called the Wireless Association now.
And this is one of the big – in my lobby research.
It is the lobby for –
yeah, it is huge.
It is one of the biggest lobbies in the country and in the world, too, for probably for every government.
I wouldn't
be
surprised, right? But
so, basically – oh, absolutely. Telecommunications is – maybe even, I mean, it's probably one of the biggest, it is one of the biggest industries in the world, if not like top five now. I think it is, besides energy and certain other things. But anyway, Tom Wheeler, who was the head of that lobby in the 90s, who hired this guy, George Carlo, and fired him too, and discredited him, was appointed by Barack Obama, our, you know, former president in 2008, to be the head of the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, which is supposed to regulate the telecommunications industry. What a genius appointment by Mr. Obama, right? But anyway, so no regulating obviously is being done, but what Tom Wheeler used this opportunity to do was to jump far beyond any scientists who, you know, and there are 143 scientists from 39 countries signing a petition still to the United Nations, which will obviously never listen because it doesn't care about people, mm-hmm. To, you know, reevaluate this issue of that thermal standard that they've set, which says that these frequencies can only have effect at that
unless
extremely
you're
high level,
yeah,
unless
right.
you're cooked, which doesn't include, right. which literally doesn't include any of the cataract, cancer, and so many other neurological damage, DNA damage effects. And then, I mean, yeah, they just actually had a $25 million study by the National Toxicology Program that was just finished up in like 2017. But they're basically, you know, you can read articles about this too. The different sides are spinning it different ways. Some, you know, some like government or corporate news articles are basically saying, oh, there's no effect. It's showing that, you know, the effect was so small and it's from such a low level of radiation. But then other, you know, outlets that I trust much more that are evaluating it fairly because they're not controlled by the financial interests are seeing like, you know, this is basically showing that there is an effect and it's they can't deny it, you know, but they're still trying to spin it in certain ways. But anyway, Tom Wheeler was used that opportunity to just jump beyond all any kind of regulation and create the rollout of this 5G technology that you may have heard about in the news or the papers or TV recently about how there's going to be self-driving cars and there's going to be, you know, microchips in everything. So everything can communicate, like your dishwasher.
And of course. Yeah.
And this is why I like School Sucks, because it was like talking about, you know, this surveillance state that's coming on. You know, you have microchips in your refrigerator and your
I was talking
bottle.
About this?
Not necessarily, but the surveillance state in general. That,
okay.
That kind of that concept of a surveillance state. And now everyone has a smart meter on the side of their homes that basically wirelessly transmits energy or information about our energy usage.
The smart grid.
Yeah, the smart grid. And that's going to include now with 5G, because it's what enables all these devices to be interconnected, because it requires such a high density of power. It enables all these things to be connected. Alexa, the smart TV, all this stuff, and self-driving cars and everything. There's so many more applications.
Oh, have you seen the ads? They keep popping up for me like on YouTube. They're called Let Google Do It.
Yeah. I right? actually
just
have not
like
seen those. What are they?
It's like basically outsource your entire problem-solving agenda.
Yeah.
Like anything you need to do. Like Google can probably do it. Like why are you doing things? I understand like I let Google do some things.
Yeah.
Right? But this like let Google do it as a movement.
Yeah.
Like Alexa, That's insane.
Yeah,
like the fact that I really do, like, I'll throw out a conspiracy theory. I think Alexa is kind of like this novelty thing that is acclimating people to turning more control over.
Absolutely.
To something like
that. It's just like 1984. Everyone has the thing in their house, their smart TV, and their Alexa listening to them all the time. It's actually insane how okay people are with this. Basically, I learned about those things, this guy Marino's book about the power line stuff, and then the Navy with radio frequencies, how they covered it up. Then the stuff about the wireless industry, the lobby, the Dr. Carlo, and then 5G rollout now in 2018. I was shocked just reading about it while I was abroad. And then I came home and started noticing these strange antennas, because I was looking for them on top of telephone poles. So the way 5G works, because the frequencies, they're jumping up from the frequency bands below, you know, between like basically a couple hundred megahertz and up to thousands of megahertz, and then into the gigahertz range, which basically means millions of hertz, and then billions of hertz are the gigahertz, and then up to about 6 gigahertz, everything was before, and spectrum frontiers, which is what this guy Tom Wheeler allowed to pass while he was the FCC commissioner and the head of the FCC, allows the opening of all frequency bands up to 100 gigahertz in the radio range for communication. So the thing is, these bands that they're going to be using for 5G self-driving cars don't travel very far. So instead of having towers or antennas every 2 miles, you can see them on top of buildings if you look. I see them everywhere because I just have my eyes out for them. They're white usually. They're going to be on top of telephone poles now. And if it were true that radio frequency radiation had no effect on health unless it were actually cooking us, then I would have no problem with it because, cool, that's technology and it's awesome. But the thing is that, like, from my experience and just reading, and anyone who's reads it with an open mind can see that there's loads of evidence, even if you still don't think the science is good and you don't agree, I mean, one can still see that it's not like there's no debate. There's a huge debate about it. It's just that it's the one side has all the control and the other side has very little money and almost no control. And so I was just so shocked that these things are happening. It's basically the equivalent of having cell towers in front of every single person's house is what the 5G is going to involve. So even if, you know, one doesn't even think that it's possible that these frequencies could have an effect on health, which is fine. Nothing wrong with that. If that's what you conclude after seriously and honestly evaluating the evidence on both sides, that's totally fine. But I was sold, especially because I knew how it made me feel living in a place and being in a place with less of it and more. I mean, there's many other factors too, so maybe that's something I couldn't actually judge. Back to your question about, you know, how could I know whether it was having an effect or not? But anyway, there's tons of in vivo studies, which is more than enough for me to conclude, especially because there's thousands of them. But so I was thinking to myself, how am I supposed to sit through school and classes of shit that obviously doesn't matter, you know, government and PE and, you know, like literature. I mean, okay, literature was kind of cool. We actually talked about some interesting books and interesting ways of thinking, but I could still feel that it was all about control and obedience and being on time and, you know, you're being watched and like this teacher would give me a hard time and I was like, who are you to just, you know, try to boss me around and make me feel like I'm worthless because I didn't get a good grade or I didn't turn in my homework on time. Like, that's what some teachers do, and they feel like empowered and like it's their job and their right to make students feel like crap.
So you were out in the world in more than one way, right? Yeah. So you had gone out into this world of doing research and finding out all these things that the trip to Eastern Europe was kind of a catalyst in this, right?
Huge
so part. Then you're back in school. And this just feels incredibly small, restricted.
Oh, yeah.
Total bullshit.
Yeah.
Like every, like such an opportunity cost. Like it's not even education anymore in
Absolutely.
Any way.
Absolutely.
You're wasting your time.
Well, you know, I do have to say that my mom asked me, like, do you really think school did nothing for you recently when I was talking with her about it? I said, you know what, Mom? School taught me exactly how not to go about living my life. And so for that, I am absolutely grateful. Well, because specifically, it taught me how not to learn. You know, it taught me that listening to someone who doesn't know too much about what they're talking about and really doesn't care about it that much, read to you from a textbook that's containing information that's, you know, on average 30 years behind the latest research, or at least as far as science goes, that's just a recipe to not learn anything, but to be, you know, again, Gatto's essay against school is like, I feel like most of what anyone needs who's new to this subject, but like it talks in that, and the way it relates to my experience is that I was sitting through these classes. I mean, before this trip, you know, I look back on the time when I was actually in school, because later on, my senior year when I came back, I only had two classes. I didn't care. I wasn't focusing. But earlier, like, I just sat in classes, listened to PowerPoint presentations that were boring, listened to, you know, we read the textbook, we completed worksheets. Like, it was so boring and I hated it. And then reading the essay against school and listening to your show largely, which gave me the ability to understand what that essay is really saying, is that it was not teaching me the material. It was teaching me how to be obedient, how to do work that I don't care about, because that's exactly what the corporate structure needs.
And sucking enthusiasm away from things that you could potentially be interested in.
Absolutely. If that's the key.
School does to other people for other subjects what it did to me for history.
Yeah.
Like, I was a history teacher. Like, yeah. I wanted to be a history teacher by the time I was 21 years old. When I was 16, if I could have lit every history book in the school on fire, you know, I would have glad. I mean, if someone just created that opportunity for me, like, here's the pile of books. Here's the, you know, we put them in the gym. Here's the accelerant. Here are the matches. You're going to get expelled. It's going to cost you opportunity. I would have done it. I mean, I would. It was such a pain to sit through history class. I mean, we would just go up and down rows reading paragraphs out of a textbook. It was like torture, you know, but I never, if I didn't have any exposure to that beyond high school, like so many people don't, and then there's the connection to politics. So it's just like training in apathy. Mm-hmm. It is training in apathy because you're associating, you know, something that is fascinating and filled with like endless opportunities for stimulation, growth, and new perspectives about the world and new perspectives about other people, with just this association with boredom.
Yeah.
And pain.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I'll try to wrap up my story so we can get to some of the fun stuff. Basically, I came home. I was so bored. It was unbelievable. I was so depressed. I mean, I thought it was largely because I came back to the, as far as health goes and all this electromagnetic radiation, the sunlight, artificial light, whatever, I was in a pretty bad environment. This area where we live is not considered ideal. And so I was thinking, okay, that's a huge factor. It's winter again. I've always had an issue with like seasonal affective type disorder, which now I know is just not enough sunlight, which is important for our neurochemicals like dopamine and all these things. Serotonin are directly related. So I was thinking that's a huge issue. But then, you know, listening to the podcast more, I realized, yeah, school was a huge issue there. I mean, granted, I was only attending two classes and I was never focusing. I was always reading some other material while sitting through those classes. So, and the teacher would like catch me and yell at me and I just would continue anyway.
Right.
And you know, I graduated, I'm not sure why. And obviously, like, I knew it wouldn't have any importance for my, I don't think it has any importance for me because I'm running my own business now. So yeah, I'll get to that. Basically, when I was home, I did go down to Mexico for this event with some people from this health community, including this this doctor I mentioned earlier, because I really wanted to meet him.
Cruz?
His protocols, I mean, from my experience, they basically healed me. Some of the things I mentioned earlier with the circadian rhythm, light, whatnot. But so that was really cool to meet him. And the advice he gave me, it was very, very valuable to me. It was that instead of, because I was worrying, oh, how do I help everyone else? How do I convince everyone that you know, they're harming themselves? And oh my gosh, this is so terrible. And he said, you know, kid, you should be selfish. You should worry about yourself, get yourself to be as good as you can possibly be. And if you want to impact people and you're satisfied with your life, then they might be interested.
If you can show them something that they might want.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's
it. And that was really valuable. So I stopped that and I started focusing on myself. And then that summer, which was the previous summer, not the previous one, but it was the previous summer, actually. I got a blog started because I, you know, basically that whole year at senior year, I was like, this stuff, I know something that no one else knows. And because of the friend in Silicon Valley who I mentioned, I had talked with him quite a lot. I was even thinking of moving out there. I had at least done some good work in reading a few really cool entrepreneurial books like Tim Ferriss's 4-Hour Workweek. After that, I was thinking, okay, how can I only work 4 hours a week or whatever, do something I love, no matter what it is, do it all from my computer, live on a beach anywhere I want, and still be making a ton of money and making American dollars and living somewhere cheap like Mexico, being able to live like a king. I was thinking like that. Okay, what am I going to do to do that? And I know so much stuff that other people don't know about health. And if it's true, it should work for people. It should provide a benefit. So that's how I was thinking for a while. Then I read a book called The Lean Startup. Basically just describes how to build a company without having any waste, any spending extra money than you need. And it's pretty cool. It's a huge, huge popular book in Silicon Valley. And a book called Zero to One by Peter Thiel, founder of PayPal, about how to take something that really doesn't exist necessarily and then bring it to exist. Because anything one and up is like scaling something that exists. But, you know, zero to one is about like creating new ideas and bringing them into the forefront.
Right.
And then there's a few other books. But basically, I was thinking, okay, I am going to make my own business. I'm going to run my own business. And I still don't think I had learned about School Sucks until that around the springtime of that year. So it's been about a year now, approximately. And then I was like, okay, that is it. This makes sense. It makes sense why, you know, the U.S. government isn't as good as, you know, I had been led to believe, and why the Serbs really don't like it, because it meddles. You know, it was bombing Belgrade when, you know, Kosovo wouldn't secede. Like, what kind of country is just allowed to bomb another country's capital city and kill innocent people and just get away with it?
Right.
Only the United States, maybe. I mean, I don't know any other countries that do that.
Britain.
Britain, okay. There are others, maybe France and
Israel.
Colonial
countries. There's three.
Okay, yeah. So, exactly. But it serves a point. And, you know, so that made sense. Okay, you know, schooling is manipulating people into not thinking logically and believing what the media and the government sells them. Oh, that makes sense, too, in context with the health stuff. So it was a very nice merging. I was very sold. And then it was saying, oh, you know, schooling isn't the best thing. It's actually really not good. And I was like, well, oh, that makes so much sense why I didn't want to go back to school and why I felt like I needed to go somewhere else in the first place on the foreign exchange. And then, you know, it just got so good. It just kept getting better. You know, that summer I was thinking, okay, well, yeah, I'm going to be self-sufficient. I'm going to make my own blog, try to learn more about this health stuff, try to, you know, be a coach and try to simplify it for people, which I do. Like a lot of people who want to understand that material from that doctor I mentioned, you know, I can simplify
you
it
kind of translate.
Nicely.
Yeah. Yeah,
translate for average people speak. And that works. A lot of people like that. And then, you know, the fall came around and I was landscaping all summer, trying to save some money to do some traveling, which I thought would teach me a lot, like learning from the world. And so I went up, over to Europe for about 3 months. And not only did I network with a ton of people from this health community, I stayed for free in Mallorca, Spain, in the Canary Islands with some health blogger dude who works at a kite center. And I stayed with him in his van on the beach for like a week. You know, I was staying with people I never met, but because I knew them through this community, I had like a trust. You know, in London, I met with a few people. In Germany, I met with this leading researcher on the health effects of sunlight just to learn more.
Mm-hmm.
And in England, I met with a leading researcher on the health effects of mitochondria and, you know, what I was talking about before, basically. And he's also a leading researcher on how life began, which is really relevant to these aspects of this stuff, because it all really relates. Life began a certain way, and it's very foundational to how all organisms function. And so all these principles that I've been mentioning, like light and electromagnetism and water and stuff, they're very foundational. And that is like a thing that ties everything together. If we know how life began, we can understand a lot better how life really works and what it's doing and how it works. I look at life completely differently after reading his book, which is amazing. It's called The Vital Question. It's Why Is Life the Way It Is, basically, is the full title. It's an amazing book, but not too much time to get into that. But yeah, it's interesting to learn about how life really began and what life is really doing. Long story short, we are an ongoing physiochemical reaction that started in these alkaline hydrothermal vents at the bottom of the ocean due to certain natural circumstances that take certain molecules that want to react but have an energy barrier between them. Life, as this reaction, inputs that energy and causes the reaction to occur. And then because the reaction occurs and those molecules are more satisfied than they were before, what that does is it releases energy. And then that makes the universe more satisfied as far as physics is concerned. It's called increasing entropy. And so what we do that with two molecules, like I mentioned earlier, oxygen and hydrogen. We breathe the oxygen from the air. We take the hydrogen from the organic matter that plants make. And and that's how we live. And that's what we do as life. So we're just going around satisfying the universe, basically, from a physical standpoint. It's pretty cool. seriously, making the universe more satisfied. It's really amazing. But so I met with this guy, like just the stuff we can do when we're not constrained by school. I learned so much from these people I met, their experiences, the diseases they had that got them into this whole deal of health in the first place. I also went back to Bosnia, checked it out, spent some time with my friends there. That was amazing. Yeah. And then I had started my company over the summer because this one of the big things is, like I mentioned, fixing our sleep, our repair, which is critical for the mitochondrial function, and our circadian rhythm, which is our daily body clock, controlling so many hormones and whatnot. It's easy to go out and get sunlight in the morning. It's free. You don't want to use artificial light boxes or whatever. You want to get the sun. It's what we're designed for.
So get up, go outside.
Get up, go outside. I mean, I do now. I do it even though my cycle is pretty messed up still from all the traveling I've been doing. I still kind of need to use an alarm to get up for sunrise, which isn't ideal. When I'm in a really good environment, like for example at a friend's beach house in Florida, the same kind of conspiracy theory friend I mentioned to you, he's really not a conspiracy theorist. He's a good guy, but
you can be a good guy and a conspiracy theorist. Trust me.
He wakes. I always woke up in the morning at sunrise because he's in a really nice house right on the beach. So,
right.
But here I don't. But anyway, yeah, get up. You know, if you can get up for sunrise, that's great because that's when the frequencies are changing the most rapidly, and you can visualize it. You can see it go from orange red up to like a yellow when it or a golden yellow when it gets higher up.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah,
related to exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. Let's say somebody wants to test the effects of this for themselves before they go and they invest a bunch of money in special glasses. Things like. What's the app that I used to use? Flux. Is that a good step in the right direction?
Flux is awesome. Huge step. Because the biggest emitters that we get on a daily basis are from our screens, from computers and phones. So Flux is great. I have a video on YouTube on my YouTube channel called How to Biohack Your iPhone. So you can basically do a few things that I'll show Brett. You won't be able to see it, but you can check it out on my YouTube channel. Triple click and you cut out most of the blue light and make your screen basically red. And that's for iPhones, that video, but for Android phones, there's something called Twilight, which you can set the settings to do a similar thing. So Flux for computers or Iris is another program for computers. It's great. You can get this Twilight for Android phones, or you can watch my video on how to get into the settings in the iPhones. It's in the accessibility for like colorblind people or something, but it's you can find it through the video. My YouTube channel is Matt Maruca, MARUCA. And then the biggest thing you can do, more important, is you can get up in the morning and then even if you can't get up for sunrise, it's ideal if you can, but just go outside with no contacts, sunglasses, glasses of any kind blocking the light from your eye and get a good amount of light for 10 to 15 minutes each morning. But even if you can only do 5 minutes or less,
go out
it's
and journal.
Still better than
right.
Just do whatever you're doing. Drink your coffee outside.
Yes.
You know? It's just so easy, but just try that in the morning and then try to spend as many hours of your day as possible outdoors. If you work in an office, try to get some sun breaks and just see if you notice a difference in your mood. And I would say try it for at least 2 weeks, but better a month to really have a subjective effect because, you know, some people have never gotten sun in their life, so it's going to feel really different. But that would be huge. And then at night, you could get these apps. But keep in mind, if you're blocking the blue light frequencies from your phone and computer, but you have lights on above your head that contain blue too, because all lights do, except a light that's specifically red or orange, or like candlelight has very little blue light, or firelight has very little of it, and I think that's one of the reasons why our body didn't develop a sensitivity to those frequencies or whatever. That's going to have an impact on your sleep if those lights are present. So, for example, you can go on Amazon and buy these goggles, basically, that block all blue frequencies, too. They're like $10, as opposed to spending buying a nice pair of glasses that we sell for, $130, but you could start with these ones and $10. They're called UVEX, UVEX. If you're really interested, put those on before bed. They'll cut all blue light. Put them on either at sunset when it gets dark or a few hours before bed. You'll still get a benefit. And try that for 2 weeks to a month and tell me if you don't sleep better, and I will be very surprised. But so those are some things people can do.
All right, so what did we leave out? I mean, we left a lot of stuff out, but that's pretty much,
not so much
the drive through it.
That's pretty much it. I mean, I got my company started. It's called Ra Optics, as in the sun god, raoptics.io is our domain if anyone's interested. We're going to be upgrading to the .com and a new website because it's still, it's growing. It's only been in existence for 6 months. I've only been working on it full-time for like three since January. Only other things in my story, I mean, I went back to Mexico this winter and met a whole new crowd of that health community that came down there for this kind of meetup. It's pretty awesome. Made a lot of connections. I went to Cuba for a week, which was just an interesting trip
sure.
in general to be in Cuba, a really devastated country, so impoverished. I'm inclined to say disgusting, even though it's not the people, it's the way that the state has oppressed people and the way that people have been so just horribly, I guess, oppressed there. It was really kind of sad to see, and it's pretty like scarring almost. I mean, just for me at least, walking through Havana, it wasn't necessarily like, oh yeah, I mean, there are cool old cars and it feels really old and cool, but really, really interesting trip. And now, you know, it's not that far past January. Here I am. I decided I'd reach out to Brett because I've been listening to the show for a year now, and it makes so much sense to me. And I thought, well, that'd be really cool just to meet and talk, if not to put something up that people might find useful and interesting. So, I mean, that's my story, and it's just getting started.
When the sun goes, that's the sound of sunshine.